So one of the things I'd like to talk about today is practice of meditation and what meditation is and what I think is not meditation, and to encourage you to be vigilant and to be careful not to let worldly gaining ideas infect your understanding of meditation, because meditation is a mirror to our life and the world. And it's a standing back from all of our usual struggles and fears and desires. But it can very easily become, you know, another self-centered project, and can become rather narrow. And it's important, I believe, to understand meditation within the whole context of the Buddhist teachings. When Buddhist meditation techniques are taken out of their context, they can be useful, and certainly those who profess other religions have expressed appreciation for their adoption of certain Buddhist techniques. But at the same time, the danger is that it becomes kind of an organic or toxic-free kind of relaxation method. And there is, certainly there should be, a relaxation of stress and tension arising from the application of Buddhist meditation techniques, but that's not the goal. That's a rather refreshing byproduct, but it shouldn't become the main purpose for Buddhist meditation. As from a Buddhist point of view, stress and tension in our life may be pacified, whether by a pill or by concentration exercise, but that ultimately we have to be developing the intelligence, the skills, to be able to look at the causes and conditions of that stress, and to deal with things at their root causes, but with the recognition that our ability to look within and to recognize the harmful thoughts and perceptions and habits of mind which underlie our daily suffering is not possible without some consistent and generally quite long-term commitment to an inner training or inner education. So if we look on meditation as a means to an end, as a means to get rid of the kinds of mental states or the stress and the tension which causes so much suffering, then what tends to happen is that after some period of time, we do experience some success in that, and then we tend to just sort of rest back in that and relax. You know, we've achieved our goal. And then the mind goes to sleep, and often the body goes to sleep as well, and that's why sleepiness and dullness is such a major problem for many meditators, because they they have conceived of peace of mind as a sort of a dull, contentless, meaning lacking content, state of mind. And having reached that state of mind, they stop their practice. The way of looking at meditation, approaching meditation, which I feel is much more helpful, is to see it as a form of education. In our daily life, we create problems for ourselves, usually or often without realizing we're doing it, and often as a result of that lack of awareness, we blame conditions and other people for that. Sometimes we're aware of what we're doing, but we just can't help ourselves, and we feel this gap between how we feel we should be and how we are. And looking at life in terms of that, setting yourself goals of who you should be and how you should be, and then being unable to live up to those standards, is a surefire formula for guilt. So you have like whole cultures racked with guilt because people are not who they think they should be. The Buddhism says you shouldn't, don't get caught up in an idea of who you should be, but look at what's going on right now and how to deal with it. So in meditation, we don't want to, have this idea of gaining a particular mental state, and then we can, or a particular experience, and then we've accomplished our meditative goals, and all we have to do is care for that and protect it and prevent it from disappearing. So this is an example of what I call this worldly attitude to meditation. We create problems for ourselves without realizing it. We create problems for ourselves, although we realize we're doing so because we can't help ourselves. We create problems for ourselves just sometimes out of spite or out of in spite against ourselves. And sometimes we have a very self-destructive streak in our character where we deliberately do things that we know are harmful, and we want to punish ourselves because perhaps we think we're bad people. So we have a lot of mixed up, inconsistent, and mistaken views about ourselves. And these views and perceptions and ideas about ourselves and about lives don't go away by reciting a mantra or being able to forget your problems for a few minutes or half an hour by application of a meditation technique. What meditation can do is that it allows us to enter a state of mind which is stable and bright and clear, and gives us a feeling of safety, and one in which we can look at the mind more clearly and develop some very important life skills which we would be hard put to. I don't think it'd be possible to develop these skills without this looking within and giving time to this process of inner education or training. So the kind of life skills I'm talking about here are when we give the mind some work to do. Let's say be aware of an object or aware of the breath, then by that intention to restrict our attention to one particular object or theme, then everything else that's going on in our minds becomes illuminated. It becomes revealed as not what I'm trying to do. So we create a very useful duality here by choosing to focus on one thing, then everything else which is clamoring for attention becomes revealed in a new light as a distraction. And we begin to see mental states as mental states rather than who we are. So this is a radical departure from our usual life. Certainly we can experience moral conflicts in life where there's something that we want to do and we don't do it. And that creates, as we know, some real strength of character, but it can also create rigidity and prejudice in the human mind. But here, looking within and focusing on, for example, the breath, then we begin to see how the mind is continually jumping out at the present moment or grasping on to something, anything, as company, or as to keep our mind away from the awareness of itself. So there's almost nothing, I would think, that the human mind, the untrained human mind, fears as much as itself. So we're very, very much going against the stream, going against the stream of our culture, the stream of our habits, and we're saying we're not just going to follow along or blindly push against the conditions that we're experiencing, but we're developing the ability to stand there and look and learn and distinguish and discriminate as to what kinds of things we want to support and nourish in our lives, and what kind of things we need the tools to reduce and eventually eliminate. So the first task in meditation is we adopt a meditation object, and then we try to sustain our attention on an object. So in the first stages of meditation, basically what we're trying to do is increase our attention span. And as we know, generally speaking, attention spans in our modern world are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. So I think for purposes of basic mental health, having a regular practice of lengthening the attention span is, without any other benefits, a good thing to do. But the lengthening the attention span is something that creates some amount of turmoil in the mind, because the mind's not used to it. And we begin to notice that there is a tendency for the mind to grasp onto some pleasant memory or some pleasant scene or imagined scenario in the future. So we thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future, we grasp onto or we create as a kind of a teddy bear, you know, or Linus's blanket. You know, we just want something just to give us just a little bit of comfort, just enough comfort to get us through the next few seconds, and then we can grasp onto something else. So this is a very deeply ingrained habit of mind, which we can observe when we don't follow it. How is the moment the mind calms down, isn't it? We want to grasp onto something else, something that just gives us just a little spurt, just a little feeling of excitement or interest or newness, novelty, comfort. So we're feeling a little bit depressed or down. What does the mind do? If there's no means of external escape by getting on our smartphones or going somewhere or buying something or whatever, then we seek to escape internally by trying to bring into the mind some pleasant memory or some pleasant fantasy. Another habit that we observe is that the mind can very easily just fall into a habit and a tendency to reject and push away, or to react with anger and indignation. So in a meditation session, you might suddenly find out of nowhere a thought of something somebody did or something somebody said which you found outrageous, and you're boiling up and just go over and over it in your mind. Or you're very negative about yourself, or you're frustrated at your inability to meditate and your inability to really pursue this as far as or as profoundly as you would like to. So what we're trying to do in meditation, it's a very important life skill, is to stand back from the content of thoughts and see thoughts and emotions as process. As generally speaking, we're so caught up in the content of what's going in our mind that we're blind to the process. And seeing the process is liberating. Caught in the content is not. And so we can very easily spend minutes even in a meditation just dwelling on all the reasons why we dislike someone and all this, drudging up all the things they've said and done. Once the mind goes on a jag, or it gets into a rut, then it goes with it. You know, there's a whole long riff of negativity, and seeing how negativity arises and how the mind responds to a negative thought, to the extent to which it runs with it, and the extent with which it indulges in it. This is important information, because this tendency is not something that suddenly appeared when you meditate. What you're doing is you're becoming aware in a very controlled environment, inner environment, of things that are going on in your life every day. But given the amount of things that you have to deal with, the amount of responsibilities you have, you're unable to isolate. So we can compare these negative or toxic mental states, mental habits, to viruses that are invisible to the naked eye, but which can be seen under a microscope in a laboratory. So we're making our minds our laboratory, and the meditation is analogous to creating or making use of a microscope. And we're going to say, oh yes. And so the information we have, and the growing familiarity with how these negative mental states arise, enable us to become more aware in our daily life, so that there is this symbiotic, it's called osmosis, between experiences in daily life and meditation, meditation and daily life. Then there's another kind of negative mental state, what we call, technically speaking, a hindrance to meditation. And that is the whole area of dullness and sleepiness and so on. I mentioned this a few minutes ago, that dullness and meditation is often the result of a wrong idea about meditation, and an indulgence in the sense of relaxation that arises when the mind transcends, at least temporarily, the agitation, which is where most meditation sessions begin. It's also also observable, I think, that if you're the kind of person, and this tends to be men more than women, who find emotion threatening and tend to shut down or stonewall or walk out the room whenever anything emotional is on the horizon, then this is also reflected in meditation. When you start to get into some more unsettling or unusual areas of experience, then the mind can just shut down and go to sleep. And so if that happens a lot in meditation, then that's a good indication that you're probably reacting to situations in the world in the same way, and gives you some insight into problems in your daily life also. The the amount of sleepiness and dullness of mind which arises is also related to the extent to which you are addicted to stimulation. We live in a very stimulating world, and stimulation, even the more benign kinds of stimulation, is still at the end of the day stimulation. And if our sense of well-being and interest and vitality in life is dependent on stimulation from outside of ourselves, then as soon as that stimulation is removed or reduced, the mind becomes lax, its vitality becomes dull. So we consciously choose a meditation object which is neutral. It's not exciting. The sensation of the breath is not something which will fill you with excitement. But that's precisely the point, because we're interested to see just to what extent we have inner resources, and to what extent our whole sense of well-being and who we are and our sense of purpose in life and our sense of being alive is dependent on constant bursts of stimulation through our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongues, our bodies, and so on. So all of these hindrances are also teachers. They're also allowing us to understand ourselves more clearly, but also seeing them in this very controlled and artificial environment allows us to see the whole structure underlying them and gives us ideas about how to deal with them effectively and eliminate them, not only from the meditation practice or meditation experience, but from daily life. The next hindrance to meditation is that of agitation and guilt and anxiety. So agitation is usually compared to the monkey mind. It's a mind which is jumping from one thing to another in a completely wild, abandoned kind of way. And this, the coming face to face with mental agitation is a sobering experience, one that every meditator has to pass through. And often the hope is that there is some kind of special magic bullet, some esoteric teaching which will wipe out the agitation in a in one fell swoop and leave the mind free to explore the more profound and peaceful areas of the psyche. But that doesn't work like that, and the mental agitation that arises is again also as much a teacher as an obstacle. If your life is more or less in some kind of balance, you will have some mental agitation, but a consistent and patient approach to meditation will reduce it radically, and the time that you struggle with agitation in meditation will gradually diminish. But if your life is really unbalanced and you've taken on far more than you can handle, and you're just working too many hours, spending too much time on trivial, unhelpful pursuits, then you're in your daily life, you are feeding your agitation in a way that tends to outstrip the efforts in meditation to reduce the agitation. So there's no harmony between the outer and the inner. So once you really see the value, or you're inspired with the quest for spiritual truth and inner peace and wisdom, then your attitude to your external life starts to change somewhat, and this is a new criteria that comes to bear on your decision making. Not only is it things, well, will this will this be successful? Will it be financially productive? Will what will it do for my career? All these kinds of criteria. But supplementing that is, what will it do to my mind? How can I handle that? You know, am I able to deal with that kind of extra stress and tension that may well come with it? Also, the immediately the more potent kind of reflections is the amount of time we spend on entertainments and trivial pursuits. You know, then we start to look at just what do we get out of it? You know, do we really get as much pleasure and happiness out of these things as we like to think we do? Let's be honest here. A lot of our experiences are similar to junk food. You know, it's always, instead of satisfying sense of hunger, it increases it. And we carry around this sort of sense of restlessness, something not quite right, something missing, something, I need something more. So struggles in meditation to deal with the agitated mind allow us to, or encourage us to, have a second look, a new look, to recognize our daily life, both in terms of the necessary commitments we make to family and to career, but also the semi-necessary or unnecessary commitments of time and effort we make to things that we assume create enjoyment and pleasure in our life, but perhaps don't do what they're cracked up to be in the way that we would like to think. The second side of this hindrance, excuse me, is guilt and anxiety. This is much reduced by giving care and attention to the quality of your actions and speech in daily life. But also, I think that we can often observe that we carry things around with us, memories of acts, of omission and commission, things that we feel were wrong, were bad, and we carry them around for years even. And if we were to ask ourselves the question, could we let go of that memory? Then perhaps we can say yes, and then ask ourselves, well, why don't we? And then we feel it wouldn't quite be right. There's this need to, we feel a need to punish ourselves for foolish and hurtful things we've done in the past. And somehow by letting go of our memory and our anguish about those actions, that we're betraying our better self, or that we're getting off scot-free and it wouldn't be right, and somehow that it's more virtuous to suffer because of the foolish things that we've said and done in the past. So it's significant here that the Buddha says that that kind of view is a mental hindrance, it's a defilement, it's unwise. And it's not ethical, moral, or virtuous to do that. And the one way of looking at this topic is to contrast shame and guilt. So shame is also a word which is very saddled with all kinds of perceptions and prejudices in this culture. The Pali word or the Buddhist concept is of a sense of deep incongruity or a sense that certain kinds of action and speech are in conflict with or betray our principles, our goals, our ideals. And when we clearly recognize this conflict, then a sense of shame arises. And it's a sense of, it's the emotional counterpart to the recognition of a conflict between action and aspiration, or action and values. So in the Buddhist concept, there is no sense of I am a bad person because I've done bad things, or I should be punished, or I should punish myself. There's a recognition of foolish, misguided, harmful actions of body and speech, and that the recognition of them as such, taking responsibility for them, and making a sincere effort to prevent them occurring again, that in the Buddhist sense is the purification. And anything on top of that is self-indulgence. So going over and over the past, and we've all acted foolishly and hurtfully and harmfully in the past, I'm sure. But this is what is the correct relationship that we should seek to create between our present self and our past selves, and our present life and all the lives and the people that we've been just in the past 20, 30, 40 years, because we're all so many different people, you know, all in one shell, one body. So this is something that we're seeking to work out in meditation, to what extent we're carrying unnecessary burdens. And one of Ajahn Chah's favorite famous teachings is kind of a story of someone who's carrying a big rock on their back, and they're struggling along, and they're sweating, and they're aching, and they're hurting, and someone comes along and says, "Well, why? What's wrong?" I said, "Oh, this rock, it's just so heavy, it's bearing you down, it's so painful." I said, "Well, why don't you just put it down?" Said, "Well, yeah. Well, then I wouldn't have anything to carry." Yeah. So that's the logic there. Yeah, I could put it down, but I don't want to, because I just can't imagine what it just wouldn't feel right not to be carrying something like that. Now, this is an area which we're learning about in meditation. So I'm trying to convey this idea of meditation not as the application of a technique in order to gain some sort of special state, maybe like a peaceful, blissful refuge from all the mess and the unsatisfactoriness of daily life, but as a means of creating the stability and clarity and peace that enables us to learn from experience and to live more wisely. The last of the hindrances is called skeptical doubt. Now, Buddhism is not a belief system in the way that most of the major religions of the world is, and I characterize it as essentially an education system. That being the case, the role and function of faith in Buddhism is very different from that where we find in the belief system family of religions. And faith in Buddhism is not given the central role. It's not the most important virtue by any means. It is a virtue because it focuses and clarifies the mind, gives the mind effort and energy and focus. But it also has to be governed by the wisdom faculty. Lacking the wisdom faculty, the emotion, the energy of faith can very easily become fanaticism or superstition. So faith is looked on as a tool to be used in this education, but one which has to be closely governed by wisdom to prevent it degenerating into fanaticism or superstition. Similarly, doubt has a different. Doubt is not seen as the kind of the bogeyman or some terrible thing. And if you doubt, you're on your way to hell. But doubt is divided into intelligent doubt and unintelligent doubt. Intelligent doubt is the idea of intelligent doubt can be conveyed by an episode in the Buddha's lifetime. He was walking and traveling, teaching far to the west of the middle country where he usually dwelled, in an area near to what is present-day Delhi, so in the center of India. And he met a group of people called the Kalamas. And these Kalamas were confused. They said there's so many different teachers and gurus and religious authorities come through our town, and every one of these teachers, they're so articulate, they're so convincing, their logic seems unassailable, and they all say, only my teaching is right and everyone else's is wrong. And so we get full of faith in this one particular teacher, and then he's gone a few days and someone else comes along and teaches something completely different, but it's equally convincing, equally charismatic, equally wonderful. And then we start to, some of us start to believe in this teaching. So what we would like is some kind of a criteria. How do you know, with all these people who know so much more about spiritual life than we do, you know, how can you decide who is and which is trustworthy? And the Buddha said, you are doubting, Kalamas. And you are doubting about things which deserve to be doubted. So he's saying that this is a rational doubt. And in this case, the doubt is coming from a recognition that we lack the information, we lack the skills to be able to make wise choices. So that area of doubt is not at all criticized in Buddhist teaching. And I won't go into the whole of the Kalama Sutta. You can study this for yourselves. But in short, the Buddha is the psychological changes that take place through the following of any religious teaching or system are the internal and reliable indicators of its trustworthiness or its value. So. If the amount of greed and anger and hatred and delusion increases, and the amount of kindness and wisdom and compassion decreases, then that's not a good teaching, no matter what it might be called and no matter what authority recommends it. And vice versa, if following a tradition find that the kindness, generosity, integrity, patience, peace, wisdom increase and the negative qualities decrease, then that's a good sign that it's a useful and valid teaching. So the Buddha didn't say, just forget all those and just believe in me, far from it. Now in meditation practice, doubt comes up, and in the case that it's a valid doubt, then teachers like me, for instance, always try to make time for questions and answers sessions at the end of any meeting, so that people can express and these kind of valid and intelligent doubts and requests for clarification of anything which is unclear, or requests for the teacher to expand upon something which has been expressed too succinctly. But there is the other kind of doubt which is considered a hindrance to meditation. That arises when we start to waver in the midst of, right in the midst of a meditation. You start to apply a technique, and after a few minutes it's not working, and then maybe I should try this, or maybe I should try that, or is this really worthwhile? Is it, you know, I'm spending a lot of time on this, I could maybe be windsurfing or surfing the net, some kind of surfing. Is it really worth the time and the effort that I'm expending upon it, and so on and so forth. So there can be doubts in the teaching, doubts in oneself, any kinds of doubt. These are the crippling doubts. And the advice for dealing with this kind of doubt is recognize doubt as doubt. It seems quite straightforward, but one of the reasons that we don't usually do that is because when we're doubting about something, the experience, the subjective experiences of that is that we're being very rational and reasonable and intelligent. And so we fall for doubt. We follow it. We don't see it as a hindrance at all. The advice here is to be open-minded and to study and learn lots of different paths and approaches, but after a certain period of time has elapsed, make a choice and stick with it for a certain period of time. It might be 3 months or 6 months, and say, at the end of that period of time, I'll evaluate. But right now, I don't have enough experience of working with this particular teaching method to be able to make a worthwhile or trustworthy analysis. And I don't want to have to be thinking about this and worrying about this and doubting it every day. So I'll just put it all off for a while. And my own case, I went to Thailand when I was 20 years old. I didn't speak Thai. I'd never been in. I didn't know what monastic life in Thailand was going to be like, whether it would be wonderful or awful, bearable, unbearable. But I made a firm determination that come what may, whatever experience it was, I was going to stay for 5 years, because that's considered the apprenticeship for a forest monk. So I didn't have to be thinking every day, have I made a good choice or a bad choice, or every time I have some problem or difficulty start to waver and doubt. So that very simple method of making a vow or an aditan or a promise or a commitment to pursue something for a certain period of time takes away a lot of that doubt. Why does doubt arise? This kind of doubt, often because we want some cast iron guarantees before we invest our time and effort into something. We want to know for sure that it will pay a certain amount of interest at the end of that. And in spiritual life, that's not possible. You can't ever guarantee it. There's always a risk. So, using your intelligence, and if there is one thing, is coming back to what we call the five precepts. If there's any teaching which under any precept, under any pretext, even if it sounds really kind of mystical and cool and so on and so forth, but encourages you to harm others, or to steal, or to cheat, or to commit sexual misconduct, or to lie, or to take alcohol or other intoxicating drugs, then I would say keep away from it. If the teacher is trying to use his charisma, spiritual power to manipulate, take advantage, I mean, then no matter how wonderful his teachings might be, stay away. If there's money involved and financial pressure being put upon you and being told to be a good student, you need to donate so much money, then be very suspicious. So there are certain kind of common sense limitations here for, you know, what kind of things to commit to. But given the fact that there's an ethical and moral foundation there, which is blameless, then give sufficient time to that. So I wasn't going to talk for more than a few minutes, and I've been talking for a long time now, but it's an important topic, I think. I've been giving what's really a very traditional Dhamma Desana, an exposition of what we call the five hindrances to meditation. And I wanted to put this meditation in context, in a specifically Buddhist context, rather than as a generic exercise to calm down the mind. So I would like to invite you all to adopt a meditation posture, and we'll have a meditation practice together.